Like to start with a really heartfelt thank you to the ARCSA organising committee, and particularly for the hard work of Patricia, Jan and Anitra. Thank you very much. What I'll be talking about today is the progress that I've made so far in my thesis. I'm in my third year. What I'd like to do is just to run through a little bit of the background situation. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the theories that I've put together as the synthesis framework. And then I'll talk a little bit about the methodology. There are results, but they're only in the form of a pilot study at this stage. Those results are in the paper, and I'm not going to speak directly to the results that much. But that's just a little overview of where I'm going, so let's get started. No matter what you do, it's always scary up here, isn't it? Southeast Queensland is the fastest growing area in Australia, and I've read that it's the second fastest growing area in the Western world. There's a population at the moment of about 2.5 million people in about 1 million homes, and the projected growth for the region is for an additional 50,000 people each year over the next 20 years. With an upper limit on the projected growth of a new population of 4 million. So you can expect with that a surge in population growth, there are demands on the existing water resources. To give you some numbers in acre feet, which was an interesting statistic, the current demand is 527,000 acre feet, which is 630,000 megalitres. Current treatment capacity is 350 acre feet, 500,000 megalitres, and current supply is 532,450 acre feet, which is about 650,000 megalitres. And so we can see that already we're approaching the limits of what the capacities are for the water storages, for the ways that we have to treat the available water. And what it means for the region is that alternative water sources need to be investigated and implemented as soon as possible. See how this works. So those were some of the supply limitations. The region is in a prolonged green drought. We've been this way for probably about 10 years. And a green drought, for those who aren't familiar with the term, is when it still rains, but the rainfall doesn't replenish the water storages. About 96% of the homes in southeast Queensland rely on the water that comes from three centralised dams, and the largest of those dams wasn't built as a catchment, it was built as flood mitigation. So there are some issues with the existing storages. And across the dam supply in Queensland, the current levels are below 20%. So the situation is getting critical. There's to assume that there's 20% of water left in that 20% may be an overstatement. Another important aspect of the background situation that we're in to give context is to talk about some of the government's governance situation. As part of the demand management strategy, governments have since 2002 imposed increasingly strict water restrictions. It started that you could only water your garden on odd days of the week, and it's ramped up so at this stage it's not permitted to use any mains water for outside use at all. In 2004, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is the peak body for a whole lot of statistics in Australia, did a survey of rainwater harvesting. They've conducted this survey every 5 years. And the penetration of rainwater tanks in the capital was about 5%, one in 20 homes, and in the region, 8%. Part of the difference between the capital city and the regional environment is that there are some spread out low density dwellings that don't have any access to mains water at all, so they are relying on the rainwater as their only source of water. So when I was asked to do the PhD, I sat down with my supervisors. I've got four supervisors, and I said, "Well, what do you want to come out of this research?" And they said, "Well, we need some more social understanding. A lot of the research in Australia has been driven by engineers or technically minded people, by scientists. And there is an observation that you need to bring people with you to really have solutions that are going to be implemented and accepted by people." And so when I was looking at this, a thing that made what I thought was important was trying to develop a framework for understanding why households decide to get rainwater tanks, how they set them up, and what they're using them for. I looked for about 2 years before I concluded my approach, and I was really quite surprised to find there was little or no published literature about the decision making for decentralized pro-environmental technologies. There's a little bit of background that I'll get into as I speak about some of the theories. But I found it a little bit scary that we can get to this stage of water scarcity and for a framework to understand that decision-making to be completely lacking. And so what I've tried to do is put together a framework. It may not be the best one, but this is an approach, it's a starting point. And so I'll get into a little bit of the theory that I'm working with. This is the Southeast Queensland region. You can see Australia up the top, Southeast Queensland, and then there are 18 local government areas in the region. Those ones that I've marked in red are the ones that I've done for my data collection. I'll speak a little bit more about that later. It's just to try and put you on the same page, I guess. The discipline of economics, classical economics, was a gilded beneficiary of the economic development that happened in the 19th century as industrialization really bloomed. We can understand that the joy must have been palpable in connection with the economic theory at the time, that you could take something out of the ground and, according to the theory, make something out of nothing. You extract the resources, we assume that they're there for free. And so you can really understand the fervour of the age and how economics became so ingrained in our society. It's remained for at least 100 years, a very dominant framework. In 1972, one of the breakthroughs came with the Club of Rome when they published their Manifesto, The Limits to Growth, which was basically a projection to say that the resources aren't infinite, they do have limits. And if population growth keeps going, if consumption keeps expanding, we will hit these limits. That scared a lot of people and started, was probably the beginning, in a mainstream way anyway, of looking at the first efforts at conservation. A series of documents followed. One of the ones that I think is kind of a little bit iconic is Schumacher in 1973 producing the Small is Beautiful manifesto, which instead of having the massively engineered solutions, talked about people being responsible for meeting their own needs in a decentralised, localised way. And it led to the development in social theory, where there was a dichotomy. There were the pro-environmentalists and the pro-developmentalists, and never the twain shall meet. And the limitations that that caused are part of what I'm trying to address in the synthesis that I'm proposing. Okay, so I'll get into the first theory. I think this one's great. It's called ecological modernisation theory, and it developed in Germany with this fellow called Huber in the early 1980s. And what Huber proposed is that you can have economic development that is decoupled from environmental degradation. You can have economic development that doesn't cause environmental damage. And it's not radical to our minds, but it was radical then. It was the first time, really, that the idea had been proposed in a theoretical environment. And it caused a lot of controversy. It still is. People are wondering if it departs from the business as usual model. But basically, Huber's proposition is that by pro-environmental innovation in the technologies, it's not a situation where we clean up the mess after we make it, but we make less mess to begin with. The second wave in the development of ecological modernisation looked at the direct effects of people like Huber. And Janique came in and was saying, okay, these direct effects are good, but they're kind of isolated, and an alternative and complementary way of pro-environmental advancement is to have public policy which is supportive of pro-environmental initiatives. And these can be carrots and sticks. So there are incentives for pro-environmental action, and there are punishments for negating environmental responsibilities. The indirect effects are broad, but it's like everyone only being one person, everyone's standing up at once. So they do have sweeping range. The last generation of ecological modernisation theory, and it is a developing body of knowledge, came around the early noughties, and it was looking at the previous steps, saying, well, these really constitute a supply side where you might have advances in technologies, you might have a supportive policy environment, but people still need to adopt these technologies for them to be implemented. And so there was much more focus in the third wave on the role of the consumer in picking up these technologies, which makes a lot of sense. It's interesting how, when you look back, things make sense in hindsight, but these were big advances and they were challenged, and people still aren't fully accepting them. So what we ended up with the ecological modernisation paradigm is moving away from the single bottom line, which was the economy, the dollar, to I'm sure people are largely familiar with what is now called the triple bottom line, which also takes into account the society that we live in and our impacts on the environment. And the little diagram I've put up is, I'm not sure if people can read it with the size of the image, but it's just talking about the triple bottom line components for the Australian water industry. One of the things about ecological modernisation is that it does have some limitations. It's very sensitised to the macro context, but it fails to reach the individual understanding of the different needs of different people. And as a theory, one of the problems that I saw with it is it assumes a stepwise adoption. If the technologies and the policy are in place, then it was either theorised that people made a lifestyle choice to jump from the pro-economic to the pro-environmental, or it assumed a stepwise adoption. And I felt that that perpetuated the problems with the preceding theories. I don't necessarily think picking up a water tank is a lifestyle choice. There are many more reasons that people would adopt a water tank than deciding to live a hippie dropout lifestyle. And so one of my supervisors pointed me to this other body of work. This is largely being developed by an American fellow called Everett Rogers, but the ideas aren't new. In 1903, a French sociologist, Gabriel Tard, said that when an idea spreads throughout society, it's a slow advance at first, then we have, I guess, what is called now a critical mass, where it's picked up and adopted by people, and then the rate of adoption trails off again. As most of society has picked it up, there are the late adopters. We managed to forget a lot of the time, our earlier wisdom. So Tard's advice there, if taken as a guide by statisticians and sociologists, it would save many illusions. It's taken us a century to remember it again. One of the things that I liked about Everett Rogers' work is that he focused on the characteristics of the innovation. So he took the attention back to the item that is considered being adopted. And he over the last 20 years, he's developed from meta-analyses of adoption research five factors that he says are critical in influencing adoption. The first one of these he calls relative advantage, which is a concatenation of all of the advantages. Crikey. It's a concatenation of all of the advantages that an adopter gets by picking up a technology. And the problem with that is that it doesn't really give us much fine-grained understanding of what does influence adoption. The other ones are trialability. Are you able to experiment with an adoption before you pick it up? Visibility. Can you see the adoption being used somewhere else? Complexity. Is it difficult to understand? Compatibility. How easy is it to integrate with our lifestyle? And he's saying over the last 20 years, 47 to 87% of the variance has been explained by these five factors, which does sound like a lot, but most of it has been explained by that first factor, relative advantage, which really doesn't tell us a whole lot at all. The other problem is that there is a very murky factor structure for each of these elements. They're all interrelated with each other, and that might not mean much to people who aren't statisticians. But what it indicates in lay terms is that we really don't understand how important each of these factors is. There's been very little research to determine the impact of these variables. And so what I'm trying to do in my work is to extract that factor structure and show the relative impact. I'm going to have to rush through this. I didn't think I would. So what I've done is, from the two theories, I have pulled out... Where am I pointing this? I've pulled out the core elements of the theories, and I've developed them as hypothesized moderators of adoption. I've gone through a process of operationalization, which means that you are trying to identify how something is brought into practice, and what I'm doing is I'm testing that model. Each of those comprises a hypothesized element. The only one that hasn't directly been born out of theories is the issue about household independence. When I did my pilot study, one of the things I observed was that there seemed to be two types of lifestyle behaviours, I guess. One was people interested in conserving water, and the other one was people interested in being more independent, having more control over their water supply. And I felt those were quite different, and so I've made a separate issue out of it. So, to quickly speak about my methodology, what I decided to do was a survey methodology. I felt that it was important that people had time to reflect on their responses. And so what I did is I prepared a survey and I went around and door knocked 500 homes in five of the LGAs that I talked about, like the local government areas. I've got an application in to do another 500 homes, which would take me up to a 1% sample. You need big numbers to drive the statistical modelling. And the reason that I picked survey methodology is I wanted people to reflect on their answers, and it also gave me a way for allowing the responses to be anonymous. When you start asking people about how closely was it connected with your ego that you wanted a rainwater tank, or some personal questions like that, how frequently do you break the water restrictions that are regulated, you want to give people a sense that they're not going to come back and be hassled for their honesty. And there is a large mistrust in the community because of our government. I was asked a lot, is this being connected to a government survey? Because everything has been managed so poorly. So part of the issue that I went through was establishing the trust with the households. And if people didn't consent to be honest in the survey, then I didn't leave them a survey, I moved on. There are a whole lot more detail issues in the sampling methodology, which I won't have time for. But what I wanted to look at is these conditions where people had retrofitted a rainwater harvesting system so that they had ownership of some of the decision making, where people had moved into a household that had an existing rainwater harvesting system so that they felt the benefits of it, but they weren't involved in the decision making, and where there was no rainwater harvesting system. And what I'm doing is testing the power of the model to discriminate how much it influences households.
The data analysis. Yep, the data analysis I have in my paper, and I'll just conclude with some acknowledgements for my supervisors and the scholarship.
Crikey, that was hard.